From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point. Secretary of State John Kerry flies to the Middle East and calls for an end to the violence.
We will continue to push for this ceasefire.
Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey warned of a situation spiraling out of control in Ukraine.
If I have a fear about this, it's that Putin may actually light a fire that he loses control of.
Remains of the MH17 victims brought to the Netherlands. Here's a member of the Dutch forensics team.
I'm very aware of the fact that to my people from my country, we're bringing our victims back home.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Peter Baker of the New York Times, Nicole Gawet of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me now from Washington, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times, former Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, and author of Days of Fire, a saga of the Bush administration in the relationship between President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Peter Baker, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, John. How are you?
Also with us from Washington is Nicole Gawet. She covers foreign policy for Bloomberg News. Nicole, welcome back.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, John, Peter, and Nicole.
Jack, let me start with you. The situation in Gaza finds John Kerry seeking a ceasefire as the death toll mounts. Do you see progress? Is that getting closer, or is this going to go on a while?
Well, today's Washington Post warns that unless something can be reached, some kind of ceasefire, that the protests and violence could spread to Jerusalem and the West Bank. Already there have been protests there. And perhaps that fear will concentrate Israeli minds. But, of course, it's a reciprocal arrangement. Will Hamas agree to a ceasefire short of their demands, which seem to be that the status quo ante has to change, that that the border crossings with Egypt have to be opened, that Israel has to relax its blockade of Gaza, and Secretary Kerry has said he's willing to talk about that, but once a ceasefire is out of the way, that once is getting to look like a long reach as the casualties mount 800 and counting this morning.
Nicole Gawet, spreading to the West Bank, is that a real possibility, and how much could that change the equation?
It could increase pressure dramatically. The protests that Jack was talking about were the largest seen in years. There were some 20,000 people. There was one man, young Palestinian man, shot dead yesterday. There have been sporadic outburst protests today, and I think so far there have been four Palestinian killed in the West Bank. So it's just going to up the temperature. Israel's cabinet is meeting right now as we speak to debate the Kerry plan. And from what I hear from people in Israel, sources in Israel, they say that the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is under pressure to reject the Kerry plan. Something like three out of the eight cabinet ministers are against. So it's a very touch-and-go thing right now, whether we'll actually see this come to pass.
Peter Baker, yesterday we had former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the show, and she said that this was unequivocally the fault of Hamas. It was a deliberate provocation that they set out in response to their own weakness to make this happen, and it was a strong statement of support. She also supported the reversal of the FAA's short-lived flight ban on U.S. flights to Tel Aviv. Does her support for Israel in that instance reflect the continued position of the U.S. government, or is the rising tide of casualties in any way changing the American response?
Well, it's a great question. I think that her position does represent what the United States government would say, and you know, President Obama has been very clear from the beginning that he backs Israel's right to defend itself and blames Hamas for starting this with the rockets. At the same time, I think there is more impatience and irritation on the part and concern on the part of Washington about the mounting casualties. You know, you heard that obviously a couple of days ago when Secretary Kerry was caught on a microphone he didn't realize was live sarcastically referring to the Israeli operation as a, quote, pinpoint operation. And I think that, you know, the longer this goes on, the more pressure rises on them to try to, you know, to put a halt to the violence. Secretary Kerry, as you pointed out, is there trying to do that. It's not an easy thing because what the Palestinians are saying in the Gaza is, we lay down our weapons, but then we haven't really addressed our bigger issues. So he's come up with this two-stage kind of process. They first lay down the weapons, but then we will address the broader issues.
Guys, I want to play two pieces of sound to try to reflect how the situation has evolved this week. In an emergency UN session in Geneva on Wednesday, Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay said that Israeli airstrikes on civilian homes and an attack on a hospital could even constitute war crimes.
These are just a few instances where there seems to be a strong possibility that international humanitarian law has been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. Every one of these incidents must be properly and independently investigated.
And now, speaking to Brett Baer on Fox News on Monday, Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu blamed Hamas for civilian casualties in Gaza.
Hamas put civilians there. We asked these civilians before we went in. We said, please leave. We text them. We called them on cell phones. We dropped leaflets. We told them where to go. And those who left were safe. Now, those who didn't leave, you know why they didn't leave? Because Hamas told them to be there. Because Hamas, while we try to avoid Palestinian civilian dead, Hamas wants Palestinian civilian dead.
Jack Beatty, those were the words on reflecting two different sides of the conflict. But one of our colleagues, a television critic for the Baltimore Sun, had an interesting piece this morning saying that those words are being trumped by the pictures. And the television images of suffering in Gaza are changing the dynamic that started, as I was discussing with Peter a moment ago, with pretty unequivocal international backing for Israel. What do you see in terms of popular opinion? Do you see it changing because night after night on television screens, people are seeing Palestinian suffering?
Well, U.S. opinion seems to be still strong, strongly in support of Israel. Something like the latest poll I saw was 57%. That's down, however, from just some months ago, but still robust support. But you know, there's a moral valence to all this for Americans. We're just not innocent bystanders to this. A Palestinian father standing in front of a Gaza hospital this week said, "I want to send a message to the American people. Your money buys missiles, the tanks, the F-16, the Apache. These are your bombs. They are." And the question is, in employing them, are the Israelis going to making every effort to prevent civilian casualties? Their ambassador here this week said the IDF should receive a, quote, Nobel Peace Prize for its, quote, unimaginable restraint in Gaza. How is that? How does that comport with 800 civilians dead, perhaps 100 children dead? People who are interested about, you know, sort of the background of Israeli strategy vis-a-vis the Palestinian people should really look at a 2012 piece in the journal International Security on just war philosophy and the campaign of 2008-09 in Gaza. And this piece, using Israeli sources in the main, traces a pattern over decades of the Israelis deliberately targeting Palestinian infrastructure and institutions and sometimes people in an effort to coerce them to change their governments, and that it's been all along a kind of, they call it the Iron Wall strategy, not Iron Dome but Iron Wall. And it resulted in Gaza in 2008-09 in what many thought, what Human Rights Watch charged, were war crimes. Is that happening now? We don't know. But any fair-minded observer should read this article.
Nicole Gawet, Jack indicated that American public opinion hasn't shifted much. World opinion in certain parts of Europe may be changing. How sensitive is the Israeli government to international opinion?
I think there's a fair degree of sensitivity there. They're very quick to react. They have very articulate spokesmen who are out there all the time making sure that their side of events is heard. But especially in this day and age of Twitter and Instagram and social media and how quickly that stuff goes viral, it's very, very hard to counter the impact of a picture of an injured child or, you know, wrecked homes. I mean, there's been some very upsetting graphic photography coming out of what's happening in Gaza. One interesting thing about the sort of opinion piece of all this is that the Palestinian people still get enormous amounts of sympathy from the Middle East, from the Arab world, maybe less so because than in the past, because the region is sort of gripped by so many other problems. But Hamas has seen a remarkable drop in sympathy and support from the Arab world, particularly in Egypt. And that's significant for these talks because Egypt is a major player.
Well, in fact, that is why the Israelis are saying, why Hillary Clinton repeated that yesterday, that why this was initiated. Jack Beatty, Nicole Gawet, Peter Baker, stay right with us. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Do you see an end to the violence in Israel and Gaza? I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. Peter Baker, I wanted to get a quick assessment from you before we take a call. The Federal Aviation Administration briefly imposed a ban on U.S. flights to Tel Aviv. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg protested. The Israeli government protested. They said this was giving a win to Hamas and to terrorism. That changed pretty quickly. Was that in response to new information and a purely technical change, as the president said, in response to threat assessments, or was it politics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, look, if you're the FAA and you just saw the Malaysia Airlines plane go down over Ukraine and nobody had closed that airspace, of course you're going to want to make sure you are acting in an abundance of caution, and that's what they were trying to do in Israel. They had a rocket reported about a mile away from the airport, and they decided to make caution the their standard there. It did get reversed very quickly. There was a huge protest. It did become politicized. President Obama, as you say, said that wasn't any political decision by the administration, but the Israelis made a case that there's no real danger there at the airport. But you know, it does look political, and that's kind of a problem for them, and they're not really giving answers to the questions right now.
All right, let's take a call. Sumner is on the line from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Hi, John. Well, I'd like to basically say that Israel has been fighting a defensive action, and much has been made of the unfortunate deaths of Palestinian civilians. However, every single one of the 1,700-plus rockets that have been launched at Israel by Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the last 3 weeks, or 4 weeks actually, have been aimed indiscriminately at Israeli towns and cities, and therefore have been obviously aimed at Israeli civilians. It's only because of the Iron Dome defensive shield and actions by the Israeli Air Force that the civilian deaths in Israel have been minimized, but they could have been considerable. And unfortunately, there has been a jump on Israel mentality led on your panel by Jack Beatty, in my opinion, who has constantly for years beat up on Israel and has taken the Palestinian position. The point is that three Israelis were kidnapped, young Israeli teenagers were kidnapped a month and a half ago by Hamas agents. Israel has attempted to hunt them down. And then Hamas began, for its own purposes, to fire missiles into Israel. Now, the consensus is that they have done this because they are financially broke. They expected that when they formed a unity government with Palestine Authority, Palestinian Authority, which is dominated by Fatah, their rivals, that they would get the $20 million a month that they needed to pay the salaries of the Hamas workers in Gaza, and they were disappointed in not getting it. So they're broke. They had lost a lot of popularity because of conditions in Gaza, which
got it.
They're responsible for, because they've spent billions of dollars building tunnels and shelters for themselves.
Got it. Sumner, I think we've got your point. I'm going to get a response from Jack Beatty in a moment. But first, I want to take one other call, and then I'm going to tee up some response. We've got Joy on the line from Pocahontas, Iowa.
Hi, nice to talk with you.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am actually frustrated that it is always blamed on Hamas. I think it's important for people to know that the demands that they're making for a ceasefire are the same demands that they made for the 2012 ceasefire, which Israel completely ignored. And it was Israel that broke it. And although Israel loves to blame Hamas, they never gave any proof for the death of those young men. Hamas is also the elected government. And so in Gaza, when Israel says they are hitting Hamas targets, that can be any government building in their mind, any place that offers any government services to the Palestinians. And so we hear only of Hamas as the terrorist, but they are also the government for Gaza. And so they think that if we say we're hitting Hamas targets, we can blindly say, oh, well, then they're doing the right thing. And I also think to myself, defense is, in just war theory, which you talked about just a minute ago, defense would be the Iron Dome. Offense is an armed invasion of a people that are walled in and can't go anywhere. And even when they bomb a house and they say, okay, you got a minute to get out, where are they going to go? And they don't get burnt building permits, so when they come back and their house is destroyed, they've got nothing.
Joy, I think we've got it. I'm going to get our panel to respond. Thanks so much for calling. First of all, Jack Beatty, since Sumner called you out there, let me ask you, do you think that you have, or we have in this discussion, shortchanged the cause of the immediate conflict and the fear that Israelis legitimately have from targets from rockets heading toward them?
Well, there's no question but that the shooting of those rockets is a war crime. It's an indiscriminate use of force against anybody, man, woman, child, who happens to be there. It's not targeted toward military targets. So that's clear. It's also clear that if yesterday your paper, John, looked into the question of human shields, they couldn't find instances where Gazans, Palestinians, were being coerced into staying where they were, or where they were being coerced into sort of flanking or guarding Hamas militants. But they cited a lot of very, very morally disturbing matters, such as, and Sumner refers to them, the digging of tunnels with scarce concrete and cement to hide leaders, Hamas leaders, and weapons, but no building of air shelters, even though Israel this is now the third incursion into Gaza in 5 years. No effort to prepare, to defend the civilian population. And it is true, as Sumner says, that every Palestinian death is in some way helpful to the Hamas cause. It's a cruel thing to say, but that's just the way these things are. The higher the death toll, the more difficulty Israel has in making its case. These are true statements. So, but against that, you have to wonder, for example, this school, there have been at least 72 UN schools that have been damaged in this fighting, and even though they've all been clearly marked. Now, there's some dispute who fired the rocket or shell that killed the 15 people in the school yesterday. We don't know. It's not clear. An Israeli colonel said it might have been us, but it might have also have been them. The point is, this is, a war can be justified in self-defense. But it can be in the way it's fought. It can be immoral, unjustified, and it's not clear to me from these facts whether Israel is exercising what its ambassador calls unimaginable restraint. Perhaps it is. Perhaps things could be much worse. But the suspicion that in some ways punishing the Palestinian people is involved as a motive here, that suspicion is raised by these numbers, I think.
All right. Plainly, we could talk about this subject all day, but I think we need to move on to the situation in Ukraine, which is also a tremendous national security concern for Europe and for the United States as well. I want to play a clip from the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, who yesterday was speaking at the Aspen Institute. He was talking about the firing of artillery rounds into eastern Ukraine. Martin Dempsey said the attack was a potential game changer.
Our concerns are not just about eastern Ukraine. I mean, this is a change in the relationship of Europe and Russia and a change in the relationship of the United States and Russia.
Nicole Gawet, Chairman Dempsey also indicated that perhaps the fire lit by Vladimir Putin had gotten out of his control. Is that what U.S. policymakers think, that basically, despite all the talk that we were going to have a game changer from the downing of the passenger jet, that this thing is moving forward, this conflict is moving forward with Russian help, and there's no checking it?
Well, John, it's still a little early, I think, to figure out the full impact of that downing. I think it's given pause to certain people in Russia. But, you know, sources close to the Kremlin have told my colleagues in Moscow that right now their approach is going to be basically to double down. And we saw from the State Department podium the spokeswoman making very strong charges that they've seen they have intelligence, human intelligence, that Russians intend to deliver heavier and more powerful rocket launchers to separatist forces in Ukraine. So, you know, the military's concern about the dynamic changing, I think, is very well founded. I mean, if we've also seen accusations that from the State Department that Russia's been firing directly into Ukraine. I mean, that does change everything. But I think the safer thing to do would be to just wait and see if maybe this is a little bit of bravado and bluster before Putin tries to find a way to step down. When you talk to U.S. officials privately, they say that they really feel that this might be an opportunity where they could provide an opening, some sort of face-saving way for Putin to take an off-ramp and de-escalate. I'm sure that there are attempts, sort of back-channel attempts, to have those discussions, to try and find a way. So there may be some change, some shift in the tone over the next coming days or weeks. I mean, we can all just certainly hope so.
Peter Baker, when you step back and look through a longer lens, this conflict raises the question of what is an appropriate and effective U.S. policy toward Russia. Many people are now condemning the Obama administration's handling of it, saying that he's feckless and weak and Putin's taking advantage. But Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration have argued that, well, he seized parts of the Republic of Georgia when George W. Bush, who was an unabashed tough guy president. And so I had Hillary Clinton on the show yesterday and talked to her about, well, it looks like neither of these approaches has worked. And here's what she had to say, and I want to get you to talk about it on the other side.
What I think I demonstrate in the book is that the reset worked. It was an effort to try to obtain Russian cooperation on some key objectives while Medvedev was president. And, of course, Putin still, you know, pulled the strings. But he gave Medvedev a certain amount of independence to negotiate, number one, a new arms control treaty, which was absolutely necessary.
Is she right? Did the recess work and then conditions changed and that's what we're seeing now? Or is what's happening now proof that the reset, in fact, was a failure?
Well, look, there was a temporary change in relations when Dmitry Medvedev was the president. He was, of course, Putin's handpicked choice while Putin stepped down in accordance with the Constitution and became prime minister instead. It was always kind of a farce in the sense that we knew Putin was still there and still the preeminent and paramount figure, but he did seem to let Medvedev handle foreign relations. And during that period, there were some things that the U.S. and Russia were able to do together. They did, as she mentioned, sign an arms control treaty. They did agree to let American troops travel across Russian airspace to get to Afghanistan. They did cooperate more on sanctions against Iran. And that, of course, has now all fallen apart. And it did seem to coincide with the return of Putin to the presidency. He came in feeling threatened by street protests. He blamed them on the West. He blamed them specifically on Hillary Clinton. And I think that sort of has created a very anti-Western tone throughout his third term since he's come back to power. It's, in that context, it's hard to see what any president could do to make relations better. Now, as the question is, should President Obama be tougher? There's certainly room for him to be tougher, but he's trying to balance that idea of being tough with solidarity with Europe, which is less interested in being tough, and he's trying to see if they can't stay together so that Putin can't drive a wedge between them. But you get a lot of criticism back here in Washington that he should be more unilateral and lead the way rather than waiting for the Europeans to follow.
But nobody, I assume, even former Bush administration officials, who you know as well as anyone, is arguing for military intervention. Do when you talk to people that you dealt with during the Bush administration, what do they say they would do differently?
Well, you're right. They don't advocate military intervention directly. What they would advocate, aside from tougher sanctions, would be things like doing more to arm the Ukrainian military, something that President Obama has been reluctant to do. They might do things like canceling Aeroflot landing rights in the United States, as Reagan did after the KAL-007 shoot down in 1983. They list a few things that could be done that go beyond what the United States has done so far. It's uncertain whether any of that would actually influence President Putin's behavior. So far, he's been pretty immune to what's going on, even though his economy is in rough shape because of, if not the sanctions, specifically because of the international uncertainty about what's going on.
Nicole Gawet, we've just been through a World Cup that drew tremendous attention from soccer fans around the world. The next World Cup is slated to be in Russia. People have talked about canceling that. Is a step like that something that could make any difference at all in this situation?
Well, I think Peter raises a really good question about whether the steps the U.S. has been taking, the international community has been taking, and people have been recommended, actually work. And I think President Putin has, his chief concern is seeming strong, not seeming to bow down or give in to Western pressure. So, you know, canceling the World Cup, it's come up. The State Department has said that, you know, they're not going to comment on that. It's too early. And I have real questions about whether that will sway Russia's course of action. And the economy is really feeling the brunt, though. I mean, we saw Russia raise its interest rates again for the third time in 4 months. They started this sort of shortly after sanctions were introduced because of the invasion of Crimea. And it was, they described it as a temporary measure. And they've just been going up ever since because they are feeling the crunch. They're worried about inflation and the impact on ordinary Russian citizens. And we saw yesterday in Europe that finally, I think, there may be real movement towards tougher sectoral sanctions. They yesterday decided to add some entities and people, and on Tuesday might move to sectoral sanctions.
Well, sanctions may be the difference maker. We'll see. Peter Baker, Nicole Gawet, Jack Beatty, stay with us. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Washington State threatened by the worst wildfires in the state's history. Firefighter crews are battling the blaze.
Some things we can't stop, but it's very hard to see families lose their homes.
Another long, possibly botched execution of a convicted murderer in Arizona. But family of the man's victims had no sympathy for how he died.
You don't know what excruciating is. What's excruciating is seeing your dad lying there in a pool of blood, seeing your sister lying there in a pool of blood. That's excruciating. This man deserved it.
And the wonderful actor and longtime charmer James Garner dies at 86. Among many other big roles, he played private investigator Jim Rockford on The Rockford Files.
This is Joe. tone. Leave your name and message. I'll get back to you.
We're joined this week by Peter Baker of the New York Times, Nicole Gouette of Bloomberg News, and On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, conflicting rulings from two appeals courts on Obamacare. They revolved around the question of whether subsidies for the purchase of insurance could be paid, as people who voted for the law said they intended, to people who signed up through a so-called federal exchange rather than a state exchange. And, of course, 36 out of the 50 states have not created their own exchanges, so this would affect a lot of people. Obviously headed for the Supreme Court, do you think this is a mortal threat to Obamacare?
Well, you know, I read the briefs that were submitted to the court last fall, and I just couldn't believe the case because it was clearly a drafting error. If the language had included three more words, either state-run exchanges or those run by HHS, everything would have been fine. But they didn't include that. And according to one of the briefs on the other side, routinely there are drafting errors in bills, and then what happens to sort of settle the question is you look at the intention. What was the intention of Congress? That's what the judges who said no, who turned this suit down, said no. The intention was that there should be exchanges, whether run by federal or state, doesn't really matter. The intention was to get the healthcare to people. What
so
is
does that
ominous,
make you think, if that's the case, do you think it's a lay down hand that the Supreme Court will say we're not going to overturn or substantially impede a law on the basis of a typing error?
No, it really doesn't, because if you look at the way the judges divided, the democratically appointed judges voted with the administration, the Republicans against. If that lineup holds in the Supreme Court, it could really essentially prevent. Well, as your paper pointed out, you would have two healthcare systems: one for blue America, in which there'd be exchanges and Medicaid expansions, and red state America would have neither one. So,
Peter Baker, all my conservative friends who follow health policy have been sending me in the last 24 hours a video of John Gruber, who is an MIT professor, health economist, who was influential in the creation of Romney Care in Massachusetts and also Obamacare, saying at some sort of discussion that states needed to create their exchanges because you couldn't get subsidies if you were on the federal exchange. And it was kind of an incentive, a powerful incentive for states to join. I emailed John Gruber this morning to try to figure out whether that meant what it sounded like he meant. But what do you hear from the White House on their underlying confidence or lack of it that this is going to turn out okay in the end?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know about that video, and I'd be interested in the answer. The White House argument is basically what Jack has just said, which is that this is just a drafting error and it's crazy to infer from it that Congress did not intend that in these states with those state-run exchange with the federal exchange that they wouldn't have subsidies. That's plainly against the obvious will of what was then a Democratic Congress. How confident are they? They think that's a pretty strong argument, but as we just said, I mean, you just don't know. If you have a split in the circuits, which is what you have right now, Fourth Circuit in Richmond ruling one way and the D.C. Circuit ruling another, it's an obvious question for the Supreme Court to take up. Now, the first step, though, is the Justice Department is going to appeal to en banc, to the full D.C. Circuit. And that circuit now is Democratic-controlled if you want to break down judges by party appointment, which is not always a great way to do it, but increasingly seems to be valid. If that's the case, then it may be that the D.C. Circuit as a whole overturns this before a Supreme Court ruling or a Supreme Court appeal. And if the circuits then are in agreement, the Supreme Court has more options to just let it go and not try to get involved again. So that's what they're hoping for, is they can avoid even getting to the Supreme Court.
Nicole Gouette, President Obama today is meeting with the leaders of three Central American countries that have been the source of the unaccompanied minors flocking to the border. What do we expect him to be able to accomplish at that meeting?
Honestly, not much, I think. Perhaps Peter would like to weigh in on that as well.
The president's been saying lately he doesn't do photo ops. Is that all this is?
Oh, you know, there are real issues to discuss. I mean, you know, these countries point to drug traffic, and the major market for the drug trade, of course, is the United States. Drug traffic as a sort of propelling factor that drives people to try and leave or have their children leave. So there may be some discussion about what more the U.S. can do, aid the U.S. can provide, and so on. But this is, I mean, how long have we been talking about this problem, and how long has it been going on, despite efforts to secure the border, despite efforts to use economic development or crack down on drugs, the war on drugs? You know, they haven't found the right formula yet. So I'm frankly not sure what can be accomplished in this meeting, but I think communicating, sharing their, you know, having a frank airing and sharing of views will probably help. But hard results, I'm not expecting any.
Well, that's par for the course in Washington. There's large supply of words, but not much supply of action. And as a reflection of that, I want to play a clip from Speaker of the House John Boehner, who spoke on Wednesday about the surge of minors to the border. He wants legislation, but he says that's not going to happen unless we get changes in policy.
What the president is asking for is a blank check. He wants us to just throw more money at the problem without doing anything to solve the problem. The administration ought to get their act together. You know, they made indications that they were for changes in the 2008 law that have helped bring this problem on. And yet now they're opposed to it. And so without trying to fix the problem, I don't know how we actually are in a position to give the president any more money.
Jack Beatty, the administration doesn't have its act together?
I think that's correct. They're trying. I heard this morning from Chuck Todd, they're trying to pressure Dianne Feinstein, who the California Republican who sponsored this 2008 law, to agree to a change in the law such that there wouldn't be this loophole that, you know, Central America, one standard for Mexican undocumented and another for Central American people because of fear of sex trafficking and so on. According to Chuck Todd, she's not likely to bend on that. Pat Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has come out and said, I don't want any changes in that law at all. It's just very hard to see how, absent a change in that law, this thing can be straightened out. And absent a change in that law that would make clear to people down there that it's bootless to try to come up here. It's dangerous, and you won't be able to stay. Only a very few will. So I do think the administration, and I think the administration is backing off on that change just out of political pressure from interest groups, human rights interest groups and others that just don't want that law changed.
Peter, is that what it is? Is it pure politics? Because they did make noises about a change. And I noticed yesterday that Jeb Bush, whose brother signed that law, passed when both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were in the U.S. Senate, said it needs to be changed, and the administration now seems to be stepping away.
Well, what they tell you is they're not stepping away, but they don't want it to become linked to this issue of the money, that basically this should not be the predicate for getting the money, that yes, they need to figure out what to do with that law, but in the meantime, the things that would be funded by this spending request are things that need to be done either way, which is to have more judges and processors and so forth to handle the flow of these kids, and that shouldn't be held hostage to a legislative debate that could drag on for quite a while. Does that indicate that they're less committed to that change? Maybe. It also suggests, though, that they recognize that that's not an easy issue and won't be fixed in the next few days, whereas they feel like the money is very urgent.
Comprehensive immigration reform, which is one of the things that everybody has called for, Nicole Gawet, seems to be unequivocally dead. Now we're talking about an emergency response to a crisis at the border. But when you step back from that and look at the larger issue, we don't seem to be going anywhere.
No. And it's been decades of trying. I mean, I covered the second round of the immigration debate when Teddy Kennedy was trying to push it through, and there are real concerns about security, especially in light of 9/11. There are interest groups at play. I mean, the best they've been able to do now is talk about breaking it down, which is more of a Republican approach, and doing it sort of in stages. And with the, you know, with elections coming and the president's term drawing to a close, it's hard to see how there's going to be the political will or capital to push anything through.
Peter Baker, one other issue this week. The president issued an executive order protecting federal workers who are gay and transgender. In the past, one might think a Democratic president would avoid issues like that because of a political backlash. It looks like this administration welcomes that political discussion.
Yeah, it shows how much this has changed as a matter of politics over the years. Now, what President Obama has done here is to expand on what President Bill Clinton, the last Democratic president, had done. President Clinton had made it barred any discrimination against gay, lesbian, and bisexual employees within the federal workforce. What President Obama has done is now expand that to federal contractors. And he's also added another stage, as you point out, the transgender issue, which was not previously in either the affecting either federal workers or federal contractors. He's now made that a category for discrimination claims. So, yeah, in the past, that would have been a hot-button issue. You saw a little talk about it this week, but not very much, honestly. And it's an example of where the country has changed. Now, he pointed out, for instance, that there are 18 states with laws barring workplace discrimination. He'd like Congress to pass a federal version of that. They're not inclined to do so at the moment. But that's fewer states, actually, than have actually now have legal same-sex marriage. So the workplace issue has kind of fallen behind the issue of the marriage question, and he's trying to propel it forward a little bit.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Mickey on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Mickey, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about James Garner, if I might.
Great idea.
I am very glad that you brought up the subject of his passing. I think he was a great actor. He was just in sort of an everyman. He had a very, I hate to use the word unique, but because it's so overused, but he was just a unique personality. I think he was somebody that the average guy and woman could relate to. And it's just funny. I just started recording Rockford Files on a television station here in Boston that plays it. And then the next week, I found out he passed away, which was really very sad. And I'm sure he'll be missed by many, many people who really enjoyed his work.
No question about it. Mickey, thanks so much for your call. Jack Beatty, I think Mickey made a key point. This is somebody who was very appealing both to men and women. My own personal favorite James Garner appearances was not Rockford Files. I love the Kodak commercials he made with Mariette Hartley years ago. Talk a little bit about James Garner.
Well, you know, an Oklahoman, went to Los Angeles, decorated veteran of the Korean War, I think two Purple Hearts, working in a gas station in L.A. One of the customers started an agency. One day, Garner's driving up a street, and he sees the guy's shingle, agency, and a woman pulled out of the parking space, and he says, heck, I'll go in and try it. and that was the beginning. And, you know, his career is an almost archaeology of popular entertainment over the last 50 years. In the 50s, he's Maverick on television. In the 60s, great roles like the one in the Americanization of Emily and The Hour of the Gun. And then in the 70s, The Rockford Files. The 80s, Victoria, an Oscar nominee there. And then even into the 90s, Twilight with Gene Hackman and Paul Newman. So what a fantastic career. And you're right, his wry, he was handsome without being intimidating.
Right. Nicole Gouette, I'm a little worried that you're too young to have seen James Garner.
No. I was just flashing back to evenings as a little girl watching Rockford Files with my mother, and we both had terrible crushes on him. So charming, such a charming presence. But he also sort of off screen had this very active political life. And, you know, I think he was a very sort of committed Democrat or liberal. And whether you agree with that particular political viewpoint. It's really something to admire. He wasn't, you know, resting on his celebrity laurels. He was acting on his convictions and you know, pursuing public causes.
Peter Baker, we're almost out of time, and I'm no political consultant, but it seems to me James Garner might have been somebody who could have succeeded in politics.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, no, he had all the characteristics we just talked about. I loved Rockford Files as a kid. It's still one of the best shows ever made on television. He did appeal to people across the lines. That's why he would have a political appeal, because he's not pigeonholed in one area or the other.
Peter Baker, Nicole Gawet, Jack Beatty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast. Coming up on Monday, Tom Ashbrook returns. President Obama's pushing hard to close a tax loophole that lets companies move. We'll look at the stakes. We'll also go out this week with a selection from Weird Al Yankovic's new album Mandatory Fun. It's now number one on the charts. First comedy album to hit number one since 1963. This song is called Word Crimes. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.